content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from our state magazine. You know what state that is. Today's reading of our state is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency. Serving our community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. Thank you, Carter Glass. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. We are going to return to the May 2023 edition of our state magazine, celebrating North Carolina. There is a photo on the cover of what we're going to read about today, which is a P-15 Mustang in World War II. And it says, "Soaring Salute. The World War II fighter plane honors those who served." So listen up. It's the second article of two today. Well, let's get started with Home Sweet Rock Pile. One of our state's most common fishes has a rare talent. In the fresh, clear waterways of the mountains in Piedmont, bluehead chubs bring nests for their young, stone by tiny stone. It's funny because the picture is well associated with this. As a fish over a bunch of rocks and something is coming out or into its mouth, and by God, it looks just like a French fry. But what it is it's a long, oblong piece of stone. And this is written by one of the best-known authors at our state, and that is T. Edward Nickens. I'm not saying you're a knot-headed chub, but for the sake of this conversation, let's just say you are. And given that you're a knot-headed chub, let me be blunt. This could be a challenging time of year for you. Better known to science as the bluehead chub, Nokomis leptocephalus, the fish in question, is one of the state's most common, an incredible creature that you've likely never heard of. These largish minnows grow to about the size of a popsicle and live in freshwater streams across the Piedmont and mountains. If you were a chub, most of the year would pass by in a boring blur as you grubbed along the creek's bottom for algae and aquatic insects. But this time of year, oh, buddy, you'll have your hands full. But not your hands, really, because you're a fish, remember? Stick with me on this. Each spring, as the spawning season approaches, male bluehead chubs grow one large swollen knot, as well as small nodules called tubercles on their heads, hence the nicknames knothead and hornyhead. The knobs might signal to females something about a male's potential as a mate. Scientists aren't entirely sure, but what they do know is that the bluehead chubs go all extreme home makeover this time of year, piling marble-sized gravel into underwater breeding mounds. These rock nests can be whoppers, up to 2 or 3 feet long. In one study, scientists measured and took samples from 6 bluehead chub nests. They estimated that the average nest was built with 14,500 individually selected stones. So then, as a knot-headed chub. You'd be spending your nights, and or days rather, right about now piling up thousands of rocks, one by one, and each one about the size of your head. Truly incredible part? You could carry these rocks only in your mouth. You're a fish, remember? A knot-headed chub. Wading upstream, I watch my footing and keep an eye on the shallows. Here at Rock Haven State Park in Harnett County, the Cape Fear River braids among rocky outcrops and giant boulders. The various channels collect small stones, which carpet the river bottom. In the spring, if you were a knot-headed chub, this is where you'd want to be. I spot one mound when a minnow-like shimmy gives it away. It's an impressive feat of engineering. An oblong mound of gravel with the rough dimensions of a party-sized ice chest. The stones are white and gray, reddish and greenish and blackish, but all about the same size. To think that a fish piled these up with little more than its lips. Comparisons to the Egyptian pyramids are only slightly hyperbolic. I watch the mound, hoping to spot its builder. Bluehead chubs, river chubs, large-scale stone rollers, and other nest builders tend to stick close by the homestead. They release their eggs and milt, which settles into the nooks and crannies of the rocks. Protected from predators, the fertilized eggs benefit from the flow of clean water, which brings in plenty of oxygen. And many mound builders fuss and fret above their nests, turning the rocks again and again to prevent silt from covering the eggs. The eggs are more than single-family dwellings. They're condo complexes for a variety of fishes. Depending on the stream, at least a dozen species might swarm over a chub nest to lay their eggs in the protected zone. Dace, shiners, sculpins, and other minnows arrive in nuptial hues, turning stream bottoms into brilliantly covered neighborhoods that rival any aquarium. If you're not a knot-headed club, but you want to see what all the fuss is about, snooping on chub mounds isn't too difficult. You'll need polarized sunglasses to cut through the water's glare, and a walking stick comes in handy on rocky stream bottoms. Find a creek that's clear and wadeable, or use a canoe or kayak to access walkable stretches of larger rivers. It might take a bit of hunting, but to be honest, a spring day on the water isn't something you want to rush. Just be careful not to disturb any nesting sites. You wouldn't want Godzilla crashing into the nursery at your house, would you? If all of this hasn't turned you on to bluehead chub fandom, I have one more factoid up my sleeve. The bluehead chub has ties to one of North Carolina's original Moravian families and to Salem College, Salem Academy, and the Smithsonian Institution. Sometime between 1850 and 1855, five bluehead chubs were collected from Salem Creek by a group of young women from Salem Academy and Salem College, just up the hill from the waterway. Don't be impressed that I know this stuff. I learned it from a paper written by Bryn Tracy of the North Carolina Division of Water Quality. The women were students of J.T. Lineback, whose family was among the founders of the Salem community. Their specimens were sent to the Smithsonian, where in 1856, the institution's first ichthyologist, Charles F. Girard, pulled them from the museum's collection and wrote the first scientific description of the bluehead chub. The Smithsonian Institution, mind you, some 70 years ago, 170 years ago, someone thought bluehead chubs were cool enough to scoop out of a creek, preserve in glass bottles, and ship to the Smithsonian for further study. You should be impressed with that. Even if you are a knot-headed chub. And now, soaring salute through their P-51 Mustang, known as Swamp Fox, father and son pilots Robert and R.T. Dixon honor the memory of a World War II fighter pilot who, like so many service members, flew under the radar. Written by Brad Campbell. It's a very impressive photograph on the cover, not on the cover, on the two-page spread which opens this article. The caption says, for a decade, pilot R.T. Dixon has flown his restored P-51 Mustang, a legendary World War II fighter plane, at air shows around the country, including the 2013 EAA Air Venture Oshkosh in Wisconsin. Now, this picture is taken against a pretty blue sky, Carolina blue, I might add, and there's some wispy clouds in the back and some other fuller white clouds below, but they're kind of bluish, so it's really a blue theme. And what we have is a shiny, extremely shiny aluminum airplane on the front, and at the very tip, in front of the propellers, we have red and yellow paint, and yellow paint on the, and I'm sorry, I don't know the proper name, so I'll just say tail, the part that moves back there. And then it says AC5, and between the A and the C5 is a circle with a star in the middle and two white bars. It's white against blue, I think. Two white squares, actually, on either side of the five-pointed star. The wings, of course, are outstretched. One of them actually comes out beyond the edge of the picture, which is interesting, and just a tiny tip of it goes off the page. And then there's two something or others hanging underneath, and I suppose those were where the bombs were. And now, presumably, they are empty casings, or at least that's what we hope. A photo by Paul Bowen. It says, Paul, you did a great job. Oh, yes, it says Swamp Fox on the front of the plane. But this is about the shiniest aluminum I've ever seen. And you can see the pilot inside, and he has on a yellow and red checked cap, or I don't know whether it's cap on top of his formal helmet or whatever he's wearing. You can't really see him very well. Anyway, Overleaf, let's get going here. R.T. Dixon comes by his love of flying, honestly. When he was three, his dad, Robert, took him flying in the family's sleek two-passenger Globe Swift. After his dad handed him the controls, the youngster promptly hauled back on the yoke and started to roll the plane. He was very eager to get going, Robert says with a laugh. Though his dad quickly thwarted the attempted aerobatic maneuver, the hook had been set. R.T. soloed his first airplane at age 16 and earned his private pilot's license the following year. Father and son never had to travel far to scratch their aviation itch. Robert and his friends spent 16 years rebuilding a rare warbird, a Temco T-35 Buckaroo, in the basement of the Dixons' home in Charlotte while R.T. was growing up, completing it during his freshman year of college. Interesting to hear how they got that out of the basement, but that's not here, I don't think. The Dixons' passion for vintage warbirds blossomed after Robert sold his successful heating and cooling parts distributorship in 2011. R.T. had spent several years in banking in the Queen City before opening his own investment advisory firm. Along the way, he developed a love for aerobatic and formation flying. Just noodling around, Robert calls, and we said, wouldn't it be cool to have something really special? As luck would have it, after returning from a lunch flight to Hickory with several other planes and pilots, including NASCAR legend Jack Roush in his P-51 Mustang, Gentleman Jim, the Dixons were invited back to Roush's hangar at Concord Regional Airport, where the Mustang was stabled at the time. Roosh spent several hours with the Dixons answering their questions about the legendary fighter plane. Jack was just so wonderful and generous with his time, Robert says. It's easy to understand how the Dixons became fascinated with the Mustang and ultimately decided to purchase one. Somehow, both sinuous and angular, its aluminum surfaces polished to a mirror finish, as I said earlier about the cover image, the P-51 is a wonder to behold. On the ground, with its tail low and nose pointed skyward, the plane still appears poised to vault into the air, ready to defend the skies at the slightest hint of danger. Roosh helped them locate a P-51 undergoing a complete restoration, one of only 170 or so airworthy examples left in the world out of the more than 15,000 plus that were originally built. Before taking delivery, the Dixons had one last task to complete. The Mustang had not yet been painted. Many vintage warbirds are done up in the livery of a specific fighter pilot, using fighter plane group markings and nose art, and the nickname given to that plane by the pilot. But which nickname and which pilot? Instead of picking the livery of a famous ace, like most Mustang owners do, the Dixons decided that they wanted to honor some of the unsung fighter pilots who had served with distinction and valor, but previously had been overlooked. As it turns out, they didn't have to look far to find one. 21-year-old First Lieutenant Will Ford, that's F-O-A-R-D, flew his first combat mission in the twilight of World War II. His squadron of P-51 Mustang fighters escorting more than 1,000 bombers as they attacked the Nuremberg rail yards. He summarized that mission this way. Flew Red Number 2 position on Captain Murphy's wing, only a little flak. Mostly I saw only the side of Captain Murphy's plane, because I didn't want to goof up and lose him. His description of the mission is brief, funny, and self-effacing, a refreshing contrast to the stereotype of the swaggering fighter pilot. Born in East Orange, New Jersey, Ford grew up in both Wilmington and Marion, South Carolina. He loved to draw, play trombone in the swing band, and could jitterbug with the best of them. He also didn't smoke and rarely drank, hardly the qualities most people would identify as those of an aviator with the right stuff. Allied escort pilots faced more than enemy fighters when conducting their missions. They also had to deal with deadly flak, stormy weather, close formation flying, and mechanical failures. Returning from a mission to Munich on April 16, 1945, Lieutenant Ford was forced down in France after his engine quit. When he returned to base, he was given a Mustang with a new engine and the opportunity to name it. Thinking that it would be fun to needle his British hosts in Leiston, England, where his squadron was based, Ford puckishly dubbed his new Mustang Swamp Fox, the name given to Revolutionary War General Francis Marion for his daring escapes from the British through the swamps along the PD River. At one inspection, Ford's superiors didn't know if visiting dignitaries would appreciate the young lieutenant's sense of humor. On orders from the military brass, Ford's plane was pulled off the presentation line, concealing Swamp Fox from the eyes of the British as effectively as its namesake had done 165 years earlier. Ford went on to complete 25 missions, totaling more than 122 combat hours of flying. Unfortunately, he and his family could not escape the manifold tragedies of the global conflict. His older brother Gilbert, a tail gunner in a B-17 bomber with whom Ford had roomed since childhood, was killed when his plane crashed in Yugoslavia just 2 weeks before the end of the war in Europe. Following Germany's surrender, Ford was given a choice: return home to safety or transfer to the Pacific Theater and continue fighting. He volunteered to go on serving his country, one of the few in his squadron to do so. He was on a ship headed west when atomic bombs fell on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. After Ford returned stateside, he earned a degree from Clemson University and began building a career first at Bethlehem Steel, then as an HVAC engineer in the textile industry. He and his wife Kat raised their five children while living in Baltimore, South Carolina, Greensboro, and Atlanta. Daddy was such a funny, warm, friendly person, his eldest daughter, Julie Toffoliti, remembers. He had just down-home quality. If you met him, you'd never know he was a fighter pilot. Modest to a fault, Ford downplayed his wartime exploits, often expressing disappointment that he hadn't done more. And he continued to serve. Ford remained in the Air Force Reserve, eventually retiring in 1972 with the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. He was also an avid sailor, and he passed along that passion to his kids. Together, they built sailboats and created indelible family memories during summers spent on the coast and along the sounds of North Carolina. For Toffoletti, another memory sticks out. Her father regularly donated blood. He had just seen the need in war, and it's something that stayed with him. In 2010, her parents moved to Hendersonville, receding into the comfortable anonymity of a small retirement community. There, Ford's combat service in World War II was a distant memory, known only to a small circle and friends. Ford had always been a tinkerer and a builder with a workshop full of tools wherever the family lived, but the couple's new place didn't have room for his hobbies. In the closing chapter of his life, Toffoletti says her father felt that he didn't have a purpose. And her Robert and R.T. Dixon. At one point in the search for a name for the Mustang, R.T. came across a picture of Swampfire. Both he and his father liked the name's connection to the Revolutionary War history of the Carolinas, and the most providential of all, the pilot who had named and flown the plane lived less than 2 hours away. In 2012, the Dixons traveled to Hendersonville to meet the Fords and discuss naming their P-51 Mustang in honor of Swampfire. After getting to know Ford and learning about his wartime experiences, Robert realized, we had a special opportunity to honor not only Will, but also every unsung hero who did their part to win the war. They told my mother, we want to name our airplane after a good man, Toffoletti says. That meant more to her than anything. On December 2nd, 2012, Ford was honored in a ceremony held in the Dixon's Hangar, where the new Swampfire was unveiled. The guest list included family and friends, three Air Force generals, and other veteran World War II pilots. Later, they all watched as Ford took to the skies again, this time in the jump seat of Swamp Fox, as RT flew in formation with two other Mustangs. Special as that moment was, it was just the beginning of a final dance between Ford and Swamp Fox. For the next several years, Ford accompanied RT to many air shows. Audiences got to see Swamp Fox in action in the air and meet Ford on the ground. Young and old alike learned that you don't have to be an ace with a row of kills painted on the side of your plane to deserve honor and respect. It's more than enough to have put your life on the line for others and performed your duty as Ford and millions of American veterans have done since our nation's founding. The Dixons made the last years of my dad's life so special, Toffoletti says. They could not have been more wonderful. In 2016, a few days shy of his 92nd birthday, Ford passed away. Robert and R.T. Dixon always knew that they were buying their PB-51 for the right reasons, to honor veterans, to keep a vital piece of aviation history alive, to inspire future generations of pilots. But what they could not have known is how profound the experience would be for them personally. When asked about the best part of owning Swamp Fox, RT could go on and on about the thrill of pushing the throttle forward and unleashing the plane's 1,495-horsepower Packard Merlin engine, or the sublime feel of the airplane's controls as he pirouettes through the sky. But when pressed, he simply says, the people, Swamp Fox has allowed us to meet the most amazing people. Of course he means Will and Cat Ford and their children, but he's also talking about the many remarkable individuals whom they have met thanks to their stewardship of Swamp Fox. Veterans like Tuskegee Airman Charles McGee and Hiram Mann, and countless pilots and crew members who served during World War II. You don't know what you're going to trigger in somebody, RT says. I've had Mustang crew chiefs come up to me in tears, thanking me for taking such good care of a plane they had worked so hard to keep in the air. Today, the Dixons continue honoring unsung veterans like Will Ford through special appearances and aerial demonstrations with Swamp Fox. Yet perhaps their most poignant flights are those made to offer a final salute to World War II aviators who have died. On those occasions, they fire up Swamp Fox and perform a graveside flyover so that when the families of the departed look to the skies, they can find comfort in the knowledge that their loved one is being escorted safely home. Well, it's kind of hard to follow that one up, isn't it? Let me see. Back cover, I think we have, they generally have a little picture back here that we can talk about, but guess what? Huh? I find a lot of advertisements. Here it is, the CC Loop Trail in Bladen County. Urged on by a gentle breeze, rippling water taps against the pilings of a wooden pier that juts out into Singletary Lake, one of the mysterious Carolina bays whose origins elude scientists. Where the pier meets the shore, the 1 mile CCC Loop Trail, named for the Civilian Conservation Corps, which built some of the facilities at Singletary Lake State Park, begin to follow the shoreline. Here, cedar, gum, and poplar trees are skirted at bay shrubs. Looking closely, hikers might spot carnivorous pitcher plants and Venus flytramps or the paw prints of a black bear in the white sand. They might catch a glimpse of playful otters foraging in the lake or an endangered red-cockaded woodpecker peeking out from its nesting cavity in a longleaf pine. The far end of the trail loops through a shady forest of these towering conifers, the path blanketed with patches of lichen before the trees thin out. The white sand returns, and the trail leads back to where it started. Singletary State Park is on North Carolina Highway 53 East in Kelly, North Carolina. I'm afraid I've never heard of Kelly. Anyway, here's the picture. It says, from the CCC Loop Trail, visitors can fish for perch and bass from the pier or use the boat launch to explore the 572-acre Singletary Lake via kayak or canoe. We're at the base of this long wooden dock, no railings on it, which goes out to a covered pavilion at the end, and it looks like there might be a little launch area off to the left. Not really sure what those things are in the water, but it's a beautiful afternoon out there. Lovely place to visit. Well, thank you for joining us as we have run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, NorthCarolinaReadingService.org. Questions, comments? Call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.